And our last case for today is JF versus Carnival Corporation. All right, whenever you're ready, Mr. Gerson.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, everyone. May it please the court. My name is Philip Gerson. I represent the plaintiff appellant in this case, a underage teenager from Canada who was raped and sodomized on a Carnival cruise ship. We're here to challenge what we believe is reversible error by the trial court finding as a matter of law that no reasonable jury could decide that it was foreseeable to Carnival that between 12 and 1 a.m., unsupervised teenagers could forcibly rape and sodomize an underage girl. Foreseeability, admittedly, is an element of the cause of action that we pled in this case, and it limits and defines the duty to anticipate the need to undertake preventability measures. In an environment where literally thousands of unpoliced passengers are on a vessel, where there are a few rules and the use of alcohol is freely and undertaken and encouraged.
But surely that's not enough, right? Are you just made liable every cruise line and potentially every hotel in the country?
Oh, of course not.
Right.
I'm just setting.
You're just getting going, right?
Well,
there's more.
What I'm trying to say is these folks weren't in church. They were in an environment that was designed to promote consumption of alcohol and a party atmosphere. Common sense alone, without any prior incidents, should teach that trouble can happen if dozens of teenagers freely roam in a party atmosphere on a cruise ship after midnight. Carnival knows that when the teen club closes at 11 o'clock at night, there's nowhere for the teenagers to go. The casino was off limits because they're underage.
But I guess just to press you a little bit, and because your time is limited, that cannot possibly be enough, right? Like somehow you've got to drill down to a much more specific kind of level of generality, or so far, like we're 3 or 4 minutes in and every cruise ship, or at least every Carnival cruise ship, is liable.
Well, I will then follow your suggestion.
I'm just trying to make
focus on
make
the specific
best use
evidence.
Of your time. Yeah, good.
Specific evidence is that we had 102 prior incidents within the past 3 years that were reported by Carnival. Over half of those occurred like this one did within the confines of a passenger stateroom. The evidence showed that Carnival was very aware of this problem because they reached out to RAIN, that's the acronym for the Rape and Incest Network. It's a nonprofit victim services organization. So recognizing the problem of sexual assault on its ships, Carnival reached out to RAIN for consultation concerning policies and procedures which could be undertaken to improve the environment and reduce the crime. We also have the fact that one of the principal offenders, Zion Emery, was discovered attempting to smuggle alcoholic beverages onto the cruise ship, and the cruise ship caught him, but really did nothing to keep an eye on him going forward.
But I'm not
discipline.
Sure that smuggling, you know, an alcohol, that a teenager smuggling alcohol onto a cruise ship is sort of a heads up that that same individual might rape another person. I mean, how is that related?
It teaches that that individual is willing to break the rules. deliberately, consciously, and intentionally, and therefore should put the cruise line on notice that this is a person who is willing to break the rules. And if they're not going to discipline him by putting him off the ship, which they could have done under their policies and procedures, if they're not going to supervise him carefully, if they're not going to counsel him with his family, that there is a risk that he'll do something else. And we know that he did in this case.
So let me ask you this. I mean, we've got a lot of like cruise ship cases, right? And it seems like here, everybody's basically debating the same cases. So you've got, you know, sort of KT and Chaparro, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, and then Fuentes, right? So where does this case in your mind sort of slot into that spectrum? I mean, it's clearly KT is a horrifying case, and all of the red flags in KT were in public, right? And the court made a point of that in writing up KT, like everything happened in public right under the noses of the people running the cruise ship. This isn't that, right? We don't have like public red flags here in the same way we did in KT.
Well, it's much like the HS case, which happened to be my client as well. And interestingly, the same defense lawyers were in that case. It was dismissed by Judge King on a motion, and this court affirmed basically on the deficiencies of our pleading in that case, not any ruling on the merits of it. But it's very similar in that those teenagers actually had contraband alcoholic beverages in their stateroom, and they tricked a young teenage girl from Canada into their room. And once she was in the room, she was sexually assaulted.
But just so I'm clear, the disposition of that case was dismissed at 12B6 and then affirmed on appeal?
Yes.
I don't know.
It wasn't a summary judgment. It wasn't a summary judgment case, right?
No, it was not.
But I don't think I understand how that helps you. I mean, I guess I'm asking for like, what's your best case?
Well,
that can't be it. If your side sort of lost, whatever the procedural posture, like what's your best case?
Well, the significance of that opinion is that it's noticed to Carnival that this exact scenario has played out before. Whether we won the case or we lost the case is irrelevant. The point of notice is, are you aware that there is a risk that this harm could occur? And it did. What are my best cases? I think the Chaparro case, the KT case, the McElwain case, which is a district court opinion from Judge Huck, all of those cases support our position.
Maybe we just take those one by one, but I mean, do you deny that in KT, the red flags were very public?
No, of course they were drinking in public.
Yeah.
And there were many crewmen in the area who could have and likely should have.
So we don't really have that here, right?
Not exactly. But we do have a group of teenagers who are wandering around the ship where there's nowhere for them to go and nothing that they're...
Let me come at that. What I really want to know is, what is it that you would have had the cruise ship company do that it didn't do here? The reason I raise the question is, as you look at the sequence of events, they all go into this club, including your client and Zion. Nothing happens in the club. No alcohol is served in the club. There's no indication in the club that there is a disturbance or that he is hitting on her or anything like that. Then they leave the club. Some subset of that group in the club go off to a pizza restaurant in another location on the ship, including your client, Zion, and others. Nothing happens there. There's no indication, as best I can tell, that he was hitting on her, there was a disturbance or any problem. And then the problem arises only after she says, I got to go back to my room. I've got a curfew. They're walking back. And on the way, he says, I want to charge my phone, if I have the facts right. And then she says, I want a tissue. She goes into the stateroom. The door is shut. And the sexual predation occurs in the room behind the closed door. At what stage in this scenario of events would you have the cruise ship company done something different? Tell me, what should they have done that they didn't do that makes them actionable here?
A number of things. First, there should have been a curfew for teenagers after the supervision within the teen club ended, so that we did not have these children of tender age, unsupervised, roaming around a ship where they weren't welcome anywhere else besides the pizzeria.
So that a cruise ship company then is required as a matter of law under the law of maritime negligence to have a curfew for anyone under 20. They have to go back into their room. At what time would you have the cruise ship say you got to be in your room by? 11, 12?
I, with all due respect, I didn't get to finish my answer.
I'm sorry.
Not only the curfew should be for them to be unsupervised, the parents should be told that the supervision ends whenever the teen club activities end, which is generally 11 o'clock. And the youngsters should be allowed to go around the ship as long as they're with their families or their family members. Secondly, the parents should be told that sexual assaults on teenagers have occurred in the past and that there are no supervised activities for them after the teen club closes. They can't go in the casino. They can't go in the disco. They can't go in the bars. There's nothing for them to do except to get in trouble. Third, they should train their security officers to patrol and to interact with teenagers who are wandering around the ship between 12 and 1 o'clock in the morning. They only had a security force of 7, perhaps 8, if you take the cruise line's view. Of the 8 or 7, 3 were deployed in the disco. Presumably, others were deployed in the casino. So you've got no more than 3 at the most patrolling a ship with 15 decks and thousands of people. There, all of the combatants in this case, all of the teenagers testified that they saw no security at any time from when they left the teen club until when they were after the incident had happened. Is it unreasonable to expect the cruise line to tell the parents? Is it unreasonable for the cruise line to offer a security escort for teenagers back to their rooms at 1 o'clock, or to at least hand them off to a responsible adult who's in their traveling party, rather than just letting them loose in an environment where there's nothing for them to do except to get in trouble?
All right. Thank you, Mr. Gerson. You've reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal. Is it Mr. Rao?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Tyler Rao, appearing on behalf of the appellee, Carnival Cruise Line. This assault was tragic. All parties agree on that. And all parties agree that this particular assault was not reasonably foreseeable to Carnival.
Well,
you think
I'm not sure
with that?
Based on the briefing on page 25 of their brief, where plaintiff states that this occurred in an undetectable private location.
That's different, though. That's saying something different. I mean, he says in the last 3 years, Carnival has had 102 sexual assaults on its ship just that are reported. And that of those, 54 have occurred within cabins like this one did. And that was more than enough notice that there was a problem with sexual assault, not only on the ships, but in the cabins. That's what he says. And, you know, that's what you need to address.
Right. And that's why I said particular assault, because this particular assault was not reasonably foreseeable to Carnival, because these assailants were acting completely normal in the days, hours, and minutes leading to when they entered the stateroom. They did not become a risk-creating condition until after they entered the stateroom and after plaintiff exited the restroom. Only then did they pose an apparent risk-creating condition.
Let me ask you a quick question because, you know, I said we've got a lot of cruise cases. I've written one of the cruise cases. It's not a passenger-on-passenger assault case. It's a case called Brady. It's about somebody slipping on a puddle. But in Brady, we said that the cruise company didn't need to sort of have notice of this particular puddle, but just like puddles of this variety, like this risk more generally. So can you really say that you win just because the cruise company didn't foresee or have any reason to foresee this particular assault? Or do we have to abstract out a little bit? Maybe you might say he's abstracting out way too far, but I mean, we can't just say like this particular assault, can we?
I think we can say this particular assault based on what Fuente has held.
What do we do with the puddle case then?
So a puddle case, if it's a recurring condition based off a risk-creating condition that might be static, like maybe a beverage station is continually leaking or something like that, then it could be the same risk-creating condition causing all of these various incidents.
Wouldn't 102 times be repeated?
No, because these all involve very distinct facts, different risk-creating conditions. The assailants themselves in these cases are the risk-creating conditions. And that's why to impose liability, Carnival must be able to reasonably apprehend that these particular assailants...
I mean, at some point, presumably, if there are 102 sexual assaults and 54 of them take place in the room and Carnival isn't catching any of them, right? At some point, you know, you've got a situation where you have notice.
Well, it's not a matter of notice. Like, yes, Carnival has notice of those assaults, but what duties arise from that notice that Carnival can do within those staterooms?
So is there any statistical line that would move you? What if it weren't 102 and 54? It was 1,500 and 700.
Well, I think the incidents here are just the numerator in the probability equation. We also have to consider the denominator, which is 15 million. 15 million passengers sailed in those 3 years.
But okay, so but my I think like the basics of my question remain. Whatever the denominator is there any numerator that would ever be high enough for you to say like, okay, uncle, yeah, we've got to have notice at some point.
The incidents have to be substantially similar such that the risk-creating condition in these cases are the same.
Right. The bottom line, though, is you can imagine a statistical showing that would be meaningful. Your point is it isn't here.
What I'm saying is...
Do I have that right?
It is meaningful in the sense that Carnival took these priors and analyzed what it could do, and it reallocates security forces. It has audited its policies through RAIN. It has sent security officers to 6-week trainings, and it has done background checks.
He said there are a series of things the cruise line ought to be required to do in the face of this palpable risk. He listed the following, and I would like you to comment about them. He said, given the general risk of sexual predation on a cruise ship, when you're dealing with teenagers, among other things, one, if I have it right, there has to be a curfew for the teenagers so that if they are unescorted, unsupervised by a parent, friend, or some other adult, they got to be back in their room at some fixed time. 11 is what he said. Second, he said, given the risk, the cruise ship is obliged to tell the parents that there have been sexual assaults on their ships in the past. Third, they have to be told that they got to pick up their kids at a certain time if they're unescorted in a club or wherever. And finally, he said that their security officers ought to be, in essence, walking the halls of the cabins, the decks where the cabins are. He didn't quite go so far as to say there ought to be a security officer on each end of each deck, on port and starboard, et cetera, et cetera. But there ought to be more of an effort on the part of the cruise ship to walk the floors, particularly to avoid a problem of this kind. He says those are the kinds of things that are required in order to meet the otherwise palpable risk and concern that's evident from 102 or 54 instances out of 15 million people over 3 years being on their ships.
So starting with the curfew, there's no notice that...
Undoubtedly, your business would take a real hit if you did any of those things.
Well, for this, also,
you take an economic hit.
I'll start with the second and third point then, which is what we should have told them. And we did tell the parents that they should have been supervising them. The parents here signed a waiver when they.
Where will we find that in the record that the parents were notified and told to do something?
Well,
in this case,
it should be in a deposition. I don't have it like off the top of my head where it's at in the record, but
deposition of the victim's parents.
It should be because they signed a waiver for the plaintiff and her sister that they would be going to Club 02 and that they'd be free to come and go as they pleased. And in the ticket contract itself, it warned parents that they should be supervising their children and that they would take responsibility for their children and things of that nature. As to the curfew question,
did it say anything about sexual assaults?
On Carnival's website, they do link to the statistics that we're discussing here. But the ticket contract itself does not mention sexual assaults. No. Regarding the curfew issue, in order to impose a curfew, plaintiff has to provide notice that a curfew was needed. And in all of these substantially similar, or in all of these incidents, none of them are substantially similar. None of them have to do with the time. Plaintiff has not shown that the time was at issue in this case. It could have happened. Well,
but it was, right? Because there was nowhere for them to go. Everything was closed to them. The club was closed. That's what he argued. He said the reason that the curfew was necessary was because there was no place for them to go.
Well, they were lounging on an upper deck. Like closed is a relative term.
They're nowhere supervised for them to go.
Well, supervised is also a relative term because there are still security officers patrolling the ship. Like some of them were stationed in certain areas and some of them were patrolling.
But they weren't on every floor, right?
Not every floor, no. But there's
so I don't think you can really say that it was supervised. I mean, if your argument is, well, they were supervised, I think you lose, right? Because then it becomes a factual issue.
No, what I'm saying is that we don't have a duty to have specific supervision of every teenager who might be patrolling the corridors. There has to be some sort of notice to give rise to that duty as a prerequisite to it. And plaintiff hasn't shown notice that teenagers patrolling the corridors at this time was a risk-creating condition itself.
So let me ask you a question. I mean, really, we're here only because the district court decided the foreseeability issue. So whether or not there's causation is a completely different question that the district court did not consider, right?
The district court considered causation because foreseeability is part of the causation.
It did not strictly consider the whole causation issue, though.
It depends on which theory of liability we're discussing. As to the inadequate staffing theory, I believe that the court did consider causation. It said that no matter how many security officers were on board, whether it was 20, 25, 30, 2, none of them would have been in the stateroom at that time and been able to detect the risk-creating condition in order to prevent it before plaintiff suffered her injury. That's a causation holding. For some other theories, such as the alcohol smuggling theory, it's a duty issue because it's not foreseeable, as Your Honor correctly recognized, that a person is going to commit a rape because they brought alcohol on board a vessel. So foreseeability plays a different role for some of these theories in terms of duty as to causation. But the district court did correctly rule that no matter how many security officers were on board, if there was a hypothetical security officer patrolling this corridor, that security officer would have no reason to intervene with these teenagers who were acting completely normal in the days, hours, and minutes leading up to the assault. And that's a causation holding. And the district court got that correct. And this court should affirm that. Because as Fuentes held, in the context of passenger-on-passenger violence, a cruise line has a duty to intervene or protect against that assault only when it could apprehend the danger in time to intervene. And the only evidence in this case relating to particular foreseeability is plaintiff's own testimony. And she testified that these assailants were normal. They were unassuming. She didn't feel unsafe around them when they were lounging on the deck among the group of 10 to 20 teenagers while they were eating pizza, or in the days that they were in Club O2. There was no indication that these teenagers were committed, were capable of such a heinous and evil act. And under Fuentes, that's what the law requires. In some ways, that's a duty issue. In some ways, that's a causation issue, depending
on which. Let's go back to the question that my colleague Judge Newsom asked earlier about the body of statistical evidence in the case. And let's talk about what there is statistically presented in this case and whether that was enough to fairly put them on notice, to oblige them to do more than that which they did. As I understand it, JF argues that over 3 years, there were 102 fleet-wide reports to Carnival of, we're talking passenger on passenger here, there were 102 fleet-wide reports to Carnival of passenger on passenger sexual misconduct. And more specifically, 54 of those incidents occurred in private rooms. If that isn't enough, tell us why not. What more would they have had to offer in order to fairly put the cruise ship on notice that it had to do more than it did? And he's offered three or four things that the cruise ship should do that they haven't done.
As to those things, it's more of a causation issue. It's not a matter of what the cruise line could or should have done more. Carnival did respond to those priors by auditing its policies and doing background checks on passengers. It's a matter of...
Yeah, he says they haven't done enough. What they should have done was the four things that he laid out.
But what plaintiff hasn't identified is what Carnival could have done in that stateroom. How could Carnival have prevented this assault with anything more?
And that, you know, that might have been one thing he could have done, but if they don't get to the stateroom in the first place, then he doesn't have a, then there's no issue there, right? And that's basically what he's arguing. If we told them A, B, C, D, if we did these things, then they wouldn't have gotten to the stateroom in the first place. I mean, that's what I'm understanding his position to be.
I believe that's his position only as to the curfew issue. With the hypothetical security officer that's patrolling the corridor, I don't think it's necessarily true that they wouldn't make it to the stateroom. If this security officer is walking by these teenagers who are acting completely normal, they would have no reason to interfere with them or to think that they're doing anything other than going to the stateroom. The only thing that could cause them to not go to the stateroom at that time would be a curfew, but that fails for a lack of duty because there's no notice in this case that Carnival had a duty to impose a curfew on these teenagers. Plaintiff hasn't identified any of these priors that occurred between the hours of midnight and 1 a.m. There's nothing to indicate that that was the reason why this assault occurred or that Carnival had a duty otherwise to impose a curfew.
So the problem with the data is it doesn't tell you enough from which to infer anything.
Yes.
That's your point.
The district court correctly recognized that there's no substantially similar incidents in that data. Nothing that would make this particular assault foreseeable. And because this particular assault was not foreseeable, this court should affirm summary judgment in favor of Carnival. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, counsel. We'll hear again from Mr. Gerson.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, we're not asking you to hold as a matter of law that it was foreseeable to Carnival. We're simply saying that the evidence does not support a finding that it would be impossible for any reasonable jury to find that it was foreseeable.
What about your friend across the aisle's arguments that there wasn't enough information that you presented about the specific incidents with respect to, you know, you didn't show what hours these occurred or anything of that nature?
Well, first of all, to get any information, we needed an order from the magistrate since Carnival refused to provide any voluntarily. And what we have is what they gave us. But certainly they know much, much more about each of these incidents because that many of them were reported to
land-based law enforcement authorities, and there was all what we put in the record was the most that we could get out of them about these prior events. And we're also not asking you to rule as a matter of law that they were required to undertake the measures that I suggested, which I don't think would cause an economic hit to have a curfew and a piece of paper given to the parents. But
he said, he said in that regard, Mr. Gerson, that there were indeed warnings. He said in the course of the deposition, and just help me with this, whether it's accurate or incomplete. He says, one, we look at the deposition of the victim's parents, we'll find waivers and notice. And indeed, in the contract that they signed, buried somewhere in four pages of tiny print, we'll also find specifically some warnings about this. What's actually in the record when we dive deep in, as we will?
Nothing specific to this risk of harm. The waiver that he references is a waiver for injury that may occur during the participation within Club O2, which is where she was supervised. And we have no complaints about what happened in Club O2. It was after.
You mean a parent signs a waiver form before a kid can go into club?
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. Now, counsel seems to misunderstand what the whole point of security is. It's not to intervene, to enter the ridiculous scenario that they should enter a stateroom and then physically prevent the sexual assault on my client. It's that if there is security and there are adequate number of officers patrolling and there are half a dozen teenagers walking around, then security should introduce themselves to them, should ask them where they're going, should volunteer to help them find their staterooms. Cruise ships are places where people get lost all the time because they're complex structures. And in the, especially in the early days of a cruise, it's confusing to many people as to how to find their way back. Am I on the front of the ship or the back of the ship, et cetera, et cetera. So that's what security does. It works on the concept of deterrence. And that's what we see in our everyday lives in all public places where we go, security guards being effective in promoting safety by deterring crime, by intervening before a situation gets out of hand and a young girl is assaulted, is tricked into a stateroom and then is assaulted by teenagers who have misbehaved before. All we're saying is that the trial court's cavalier finding that there was no similarity between the priors and the instant incident was not explained, is not justifiable. This was foreseeable to Carnival just based on common sense that you put thousands of people on a ship and there's no police and you have a lot of teenagers who are unsupervised, something bad is going to happen. It was foreseeable because there were 102 priors. It was foreseeable because there were reported opinions of substantially similar outcomes victimizing teenage girls. It was foreseeable because they consulted Rain in order to get advice on how to improve their policies and procedures. It was foreseeable because the vice president of security for Carnival, Mr. Forio, testified that the security deployment was not adequate in his opinion, and that he asked senior management for more security guards, and they told him no. Over and over and over again, he says, over a period of years. Finally, it was foreseeable specifically because they knew that Zion Emery was a troublemaker who would break the rules in one way. And if they knew that, there should have been measures undertaken to single him out and be specially observant of him to prevent him from acting out illegally in another way to harm an innocent person.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both for your arguments today, and we'll be in recess until tomorrow.